Well, good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, in our last consideration of David, which was sometime during last year, we left David at the point that he had reached the pinnacle. Well, not the pinnacle, it was the turning point. There's a much better description, the turning point of his life. It was not only the turning point of his life, it was the turning point of the nation. And we saw that the joy and certainty and fellowship, the confidence that had surrounded David in those years leading up to that point, from the time he'd become king in Hebron, was all now to be gone. And evil powers had been released upon the nation, which would stalk the kingdom like beasts of prey, as one writer said. Well, we know what the apostle says in Galatians 6, that well-known saying that whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. And in David's life, as in all of our lives, brethren and sisters, sin stains, it warps, it scars the sinner. And forgiveness removes the eternal consequences of sin. And David was forgiven in an amazing situation by God when Nathan was sent back to him sometime after his sin. But it leaves the temporary after effects of sin in the sinner's life for their necessary chastening. You know, I think that's the only way we can make sense of much of the record that follows after David. Now, there's an enormous number of issues that come out of this period of David's life, but here is a key that we can never lose sight of: that forgiveness does not purge us of sin. It removes, God removes the sin from us, and from an eternal point of view, sin is gone forever. He will never bring it back to us. But the consequences, the ramifications, the after effects of sin will continue in the lives of sinners, and God uses those for necessary chastening to help us really come to grips with the awfulness of sin in our lives. And so it was with David. You know, many people have actually said, and I've seen it in writing as well as heard people speak of David like this after his sin, that he was a shadow of the former David. He was a much lesser man after his sin. You know, it is true that David was not the same man after his sin with Bathsheba. No one, all of us, brothers and sisters, none of us can be the same after we sin, because sin affects us. We need to understand that sin does affect us. And sometimes we're self-deceived at how seriously sin affects us. But in the end, David, I believe, was a far greater man than he ever was before. And in fact, God used the circumstances that followed his sin to purge him and to help him understand things that he couldn't have understood and he didn't understand by experience before. So this record that's laid out for us following David's sin in enormous detail, and it is enormous detail, we often wonder just why there's all this record there. Well, it's not, absolutely not, for us to judge David. There's no question. God has never put the lives of individuals on paper for us to sit 2,000 years or however long afterwards and point the finger and determine what we think this person should have done in this circumstances and why they went wrong. Now, we can see their failings, and they're there for us. They're for us to identify with, and they're for us to learn lessons from. You know, we've all fallen into sin, and we know what David went through by our own experience. We all experience that, brothers and sisters, from time to time. Perhaps we might feel as though we've never quite got to the depths of what David did, but we never either reached the heights that David ever did before or after. But you know, brothers and sisters, I don't think we're so good at dealing with the consequences of sin in our lives. And this is where I think we need the most help. And this record, from 2 Samuel 13 onwards, basically to the end of 2 Samuel, is a record where the Spirit of God decided that we needed a help to understand and to deal in our own lives with the consequences of sin. And in the end, as we traverse through this period of David's life, we're going to find that what emerges is not a weaker David. We're going to find a spiritual giant emerging from the end of this period. A man with little pride, with no self-importance, not relying on himself, but with a relationship that was so strong with his God, his trust in God's promises, that it will inspire any who give their mind and attention to it. Well, here's David's life. We've seen this slide before. But we find here that really that the life of David can be divided into three sections. And over the last couple of years, we've been traversing that middle section, the rise of the kingdom. When David came to power at 30, came to, as king at the age of 30, through to the time of his sin, which was around about the period of, when he was about 45, it's possibly a fraction after that. We can't determine that exactly, but we can actually isolate it to within a fairly narrow period. But from then on to the end of his life was really a period of the decline of the kingdom. The rise of David in spiritual strength towards the end of that, but unquestionably the demise of the kingdom, the decline of the kingdom through that period. Covers a period of roughly 25 years. And includes, I think, what does it say there, 22 chapters? That's enormous, brothers and sisters, enormous. The amount of the divine historical record that's given to these chapters is never found of almost any other person in all of recorded biblical history. So we oughtn't to skim too quickly across that, even though, you know, tonight we're going to try and sort of cover the events of a couple of chapters and following. The fortnight will do similar. It's these chapters are certainly well worth us spending a little time to consider. And not only that, brothers and sisters, there are multiple sons. In fact, this period of the decline of the kingdom, this latter 25 years of David's life, and particularly one small narrow section of it, was the most prolific period of his psalm writing in the whole of his life. And some of the most amazing psalms that were found in the mouth of Messiah came from this period. So there's a great deal for us all to learn during this whole period. It's a very understudied part of David's life, I feel. And I'm enjoying spending some time there, and I hope you do too. Well, here's a bit busy slide, I suppose, but this is just looking at this latter period from the time David was from the time he was about 45, roughly. His sin occurred in this sort of region. You can narrow that down to between about 45 and 50 in that sort of region. Then we find, you know, this rolling series of horrendous events. It's just tragedy tumbling upon suffering and grief and stuff for almost the rest of David's life, with only very short periods of happiness for him through that whole period. And what dominates the first part of it is the Absalom era. We're going to be starting to have a look at that tonight, which basically starts with the circumstances that we've read in 2 Samuel 13 there. But as you can see, it was studded with the deaths of four of his sons, one just before his own death in the end, which brought the reality of the impact of sin home to David in every day of his life. So these last 20 years of his life saw the ripples of sin move out through his family and eventually into the nation. But before we actually get into 2 Samuel 13... I just want to lay a bit of background, really, just to pull a few threads together about David's own family. I must admit that, you know, some time ago, possibly not just before I started this study, but some time ago, I think reading through this latter part of David's life, I had completely the wrong idea of some of the personalities in there. I had no idea how old they were, what was the situation. I hadn't really thought a great deal about it. But so what I'd like to do is just lay a bit of a background for a few minutes. David actually made two big mistakes in his life that had a huge impact on his family and his later life. And the first of those mistakes was that he married many wives. And that should be an obvious one. But while polygamy is not explicitly forbidden in the Bible, it's never endorsed, and it brings with it an enormous number of complications and problems, as we could well and truly imagine, and as have been outlined many times through other examples of the lives of faithful men and women who found themselves in this circumstance. But for David, it was despite the advice of Deuteronomy 17, verse 17. You'll remember that kings, when they first came, and David only being the second king in Israel, and being such a lover of the law, should and must have read these words, that kings were not to multiply wives or riches or horses. And in fact, David really didn't multiply those other things, but he did marry a number of wives. There's at least eight named wives of David, and he married more, plus concubines. In fact, there's the named wives of David, and at the times that he married them. His first wife, as we know, was given to him and then taken away, and he got her returned. But then he married Abigail and in Ahinoam in the wilderness, and then more wives in Hebron, and more wives when he came to Jerusalem. It's sort of almost like this expectation that people in the status of a king would have many wives because they could support them. But David's family was therefore consequently large, and there's the wives that we know. There were more wives and more concubines here that produced more sons. In fact, he had at least 20 odd sons that we know of, plus more. It does say that he had more than that. And he had daughters as well. So it was a pretty large family. And what that situation with so many wives and diverse wives brought into his family was a great deal of division and tension and much difficulty. In fact, there was a huge problem in bringing up children, because each wife and their children, and interestingly, most of those wives are only said to have one child. Now, they may well have had more, but it's interesting that there is none of David's named wives that have got named children, more than one, except for Bathsheba. And all four sons of Bathsheba are named. And Bathsheba, the family that David had with Bathsheba, stands in enormous contrast to the families that he had with all his other wives, as we'll see a bit later on. Well, what actually happened as a result of this, as you can imagine, there were all these different wives. They probably lived in different sections of the palace. They, with their own children, or at least for part of the time, and had servants looking after them. They possibly had, you know, even separate quarters. We don't know exactly how that would have happened, but they must have been to some degree like little independent families within one roof. And David could not possibly be a father to all of those children all the time, because they had so many different mothers, and it was just very, very difficult for David to have an influence. Besides which, he'd become king by the time he was king, before he had any of his children. They were all born after he'd become king in Hebron. So as they're growing up, David is fighting wars and very involved in much of what was happening in the kingship. And so his children had grown up with servants around them, with all these different wives, with different values. Some of them, like Absalom's mother, was a princess from a far country. So they brought with them all kinds of baggage. And David, undoubtedly, there's evidence all through David's life of his intense love for his children, but because of what he was involved in and because of the circumstance of his family, it seemed as though he had very little direct and immediate influence on many of his children, at least the older children. And so they grew up, as children will, independent, and there was little cohesion in the family. They grew up not as brothers, they grew up as competitors. They grew up quite undisciplined and ungodly. Some of them were self-seeking and proud. And we know the characteristics. By the time they were in their late teens, they were a bit of a handful. And partly a result of just the whole set of circumstances that family was in at the time. Well, the second big mistake that David made, obviously, was his sin with Bathsheba. And then the consequences that flowed out of that in the death of Uriah and all the other things that happened as a result of that. Not only is this a heinous crime, brothers and sisters, but it profoundly affected his sons in particular. And, you know, we can actually work out roughly how old David's sons were at this time. Now, I don't have an actual chart, but if I go back here for a second, you can see that, no, I have to go back further. There we'll go. This is where David came to the throne at the age of 30, and it says he married two wives in the wilderness, and they are the first two wives that bore him children. His firstborn was Amnon, and his second son was Absalom. And probably quite a number of his sons were born in very quick succession. They could have even been born in the same year. We don't know, because they're all born of different mothers. The whole list of his first seven sons are all born to different mothers. And it's likely that they were born very early in his kingship here. So let's just say they were born around, at least his eldest, was born around the time when he was 32. Well, we're talking about the time of David's sin being around, say, 47. His firstborn son, Amnon, would have been about 14 or 15 at the time. And by the time we get to this chapter that we've read tonight, 2 Samuel 13, and the events that happen there with Amnon, Amnon's only in his late teens. He's not a grown man of 35. He's only probably 18 or 19 at the time. We can't be sure of his exact age, but he can't be very much older than that. That's quite amazing when you think about this, because we've got to put into context now, all that happens and after here is only happening with people that are barely out of their teens, his sons that are barely out of their teens. Now, if you take these sons who are growing up, Amnon and Absalom and Adonijah, who probably were very close in age, and they're the three sons that caused him the most trouble, as we know, and all of whom lost their lives. They were three of the casualties of his sin. And they were all old enough at 15 to know what was going on in the palace, although it would have been very hushed and they would have heard rumours and tension and David being very different whenever they saw him, and things went on and on, and it appears that people weren't talking to each other and they were whispering behind closed doors, and the military people were coming in and going, and all manner of things were all happening, and these boys of 15, 16 or 14, 13, as they went down at very impressionable teenage years. And then the record falls silent. There's a break. You come to the record here in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 31. The end, right at the very end of chapter 12, this is the time where we find out that Nathan came, and then we find about the death of the child that is born to Bathsheba. And then David takes Rabbah. So we read right at the end, so David and all the children, all the people returned unto Jerusalem. And it came to pass. So those events in chapter 12 happened, you know, within a relatively short time after the revelation of David's sin and all the things that happened around there. And then it says, and it came to pass after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. So around this time, Amnon is probably around 18 or 19 years of age, and Absalom would have been similar sort of age, perhaps a bit younger. And Tamar would have been, we don't know, but let's assume that that Absalom was about 18 at the time. Tamar could have been 16, she could have even been younger. So we get a bit of a sense of the family relationships that were going on just from this record. I wonder how much you noticed when we just read chapter 13 tonight. We find, first of all, in verse 2 that Amnon is absolutely infatuated with his sister Tamar in an impure way. He is only 19 and his sister is 16, say, that sort of age. And Amnon's got this friend, inverted commas, this cunning man, it says. He's presumably around his sort of age. He was worse than any worst enemy he could have imagined in his company. How did he get into the palace? We wonder. In fact, there's a bit of a hint because it says that he was the... How does it describe him? Where do we find it? He was the son of Shimea, David's brother. So it was family connection that he got himself in there, and he was no good for any of David's sons. And David's sons were allowed to associate with him. And David had him in the palace and obviously didn't know what he was like. So David was so occupied with other things and following his sin, obviously, consumed by that for much of the time. Verse 4 tells us that, notice there in verse 4 how Tamar is described. And Amnon said unto him, this is unto this his friend, Jonadab, he said, Amnon said unto him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Oh, that's a bit of a strange way to put things, isn't it? Why didn't he just say, I love Tamar, my sister? Because he was his sister. But how come he calls him my brother Absalom's sister? Somehow, Absalom and Tamar are connected. And this is Absalom's sister. Because it appears that the oldest sons in each of these family groups in the palace became like in charge of the younger ones. So Absalom had taken under his wing Tamar and was looking after her. He certainly had a great deal of feeling for her and certainly wanted to protect her. But you notice this same thing goes on. Verse 7, and Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house. Amnon's 19 and it says to his house. Now, does that just say, oh, to his... What does it mean? A section in the palace, not a separate house? Does it? Who knows? But it's saying a separate house because somehow these little groups had actually formed. And we find in verse 8, it talks about the same thing, Amnon's house again. And verse 20, we find, and Absalom, her brother, said unto her, hath Amnon thy brother been with thee, etc. And so Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. So there's these houses, and these boys are only in their late teens. And look at verse 6. So Amnon laid down and made himself sick, and when the king was come to see him, the king, it's not his father. The relationship that Amnon had with David was, he was the king. And Amnon said unto the king, I pray thee, let Tamar my sister come. And so David goes and organises everything. And clearly David's unaware of the nature of Amnon's character and what he was like. You know, Jonadab knew what he was like, and Absalom absolutely knew what he was like because he saw Tamar coming into the palace and she was crying and had garments rent and what he said. And the very first thing he said, has Amnon been anywhere near you? So his character was known. And it wasn't very complimentary. Well, the very first picture we see of David's life and of David's house after his sin is just what we've read tonight. That's the very first thing that we see. This is a picture of David's domestic circle immediately after his sin. Now, it might be a few years. In fact, I'm pretty sure that it is a few years after his sin. And we're presented with Amnon, his firstborn. There's an absolute epitome of the flesh. He's prone to evil. He's driven by lust. He's not receptive to godliness. He won't listen to reason. He's self-willed. He's forceful. He's violent. He's got no pity. What is the record telling us, brethren and sisters? Well, you remember, we won't turn back to it. It's only a few pages back, but you can turn to it if you like. 2 Samuel 12, verse... it's only the previous page. Go there. 2 Samuel 12, verse 9, records the words that Nathan spoke to David after he'd given that little parable to reveal his sin to him. And they were terrible words that no doubt were burnt into David's memory forever. They tormented David every day of his life, and God knew that that was to be the case, because one of the things that he said, and you'll notice up here, because David, you have killed Uriah, taken his wife, and you did it all secretly, because of that, the sword will never depart out of your house. Never. Look at that. Never. That is amazing. And evil shall arise from within your house, and I'll do this thing for all Israel. So what we find, brethren and sisters, is this starting to emerge. This is the first bit. Evil shall arise from within your house. Now, this is not God deciding that he's going to bring this amazing punishment on David. These things were already in train, and the natural outworking of the circumstances of David's life were going to bring about evil coming out of his own house. And the next 12 chapters of David's life is the story of that evil emerging from his own house. And from his own house, we find deceit and division and hatred and grief like we could hardly believe, and adultery and murder. From his house, brothers and sisters, came the source of a fountain that spewed out and eventually affected the nation. As I said, God doesn't actually punish us for our sins, but by them. And here was the natural consequences of David's decisions earlier in his life that were used providentially by God, not only for David's good, but as a purging of sin in his own life as well. But, you know, this was really only the beginning. Because in David's house at this stage, the evil was contained. It was contained to his own house. And we've just read tonight about Amnon and the horrific actions of his firstborn son in his lust, and then in his heartlessness, and then in his violence in throwing Tamar out and hating her and not wanting anything to do with it. And he seems to get away with it. And then there's the terrible tragedy that's left in that house too, with Tamar having been abused and humiliated and rejected, and now in great shame and mourning. She can never face anyone, and she doesn't know where she can go. She looks like she's just going to have to live in that state for the rest of her life. And the whole thing's all hushed up inside the house. Verse 19. And Tamar put ashes on her head and rent her garment of divers colours that was on her, and laid her hand on her head and went on crying. She'd come out of Amnon's house. We might ask, where was David? She didn't bump into David. Verse 20, and Absalom, her brother, bumped into her and said to her, "Hath Amnon, thy brother, been with thee?" He could see he had. He could see just by what he saw. He was incensed. And he said, "Hold your peace, my sister. He is thy brother. Don't regard this thing. Come into my house and just live there." The whole thing was hushed. "Don't say anything. Don't do anything. Just come and live with me." Verse 21. But when King David heard all these things, he was very wroth. David gets incredibly angry, but does nothing. angry because of the uncontrolled lust and deceit and humiliation that Amnon has inflicted on his daughter. But as soon as David thought about those things, brothers and sisters, as soon as he thought about uncontrolled lust and deceit and humiliation, he's staring his own sin in the face. And by painful memory, he's probably not only angry because of what Amnon's done, he's angry because he can see it being mirrored in a worse form in his own son, his own firstborn son. He was angry with himself, brothers and sisters, because he could see what was happening. And you know, I think it was that held his tongue and restrained his hand. It was the consciousness of the similarity of what had gone on, though it was quite different in many respects, but in principle similar, that led David to not be able to do anything or say anything, though he should have. And we're not here to judge him, brothers and sisters, but this terrible train of events follows from here. You know what Ecclesiastes 8 says? It says, because a sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Well, here is a perfect example of that principle. Was there to be no punishment for this eldest son? Was there nothing to mark his father's displeasure or to prevent some reoccurrence of this? Was Amnon to actually just walk as he normally did through the palace and with all the privileges that he'd had before as a prince? With nothing to neutralise his influence on his siblings and nothing to prevent a repetition of what had just gone on? Well, not everyone even knew, apart from whispers behind doors. No one was talking about it publicly. But it appears, though we're not sure, brothers and sisters, it appears that really nothing was done. Because Amnon himself seems to be just come up in the record again as though he's got all the same privileges that everyone else had before. Well, it appears then from this that something far more serious grew. Because it wasn't dealt with at that point. Because David was incapable of doing it. Verse 22. And Absalom spake unto his brother Amnon, neither good or bad. For Absalom hated Amnon because he'd forced his sister Tamar. It worked strong emotions in Absalom as well. Because he loved his sister. It brought division into the house. It brought hatred. There was already some forms of division there, but now it was entrenched. And you notice this relationship here between Absalom and Tamar. He did care for her, as we found in verse 22. Back in verse 20, and Absalom, her brother, said unto her, he found her and took care of her. He took her into his house. As verse 20 says, and there's an interesting description in verse 4, did you notice? When Amnon is talking about to Jonadab, he says, I love Tamar, my brother, Absalom's sister. So there was a clear relationship here. But you know, this all starts actually in verse 1. Did you notice? How many times have we actually read this chapter and we've never noticed this perhaps? I don't know, I hadn't until relatively recently. That verse 1 says, and it came to pass after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon loved the son of David. Sorry, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. And you might say, oh yes, that's interesting. We're told that Absalom had a sister, fair sister, and he loved her. He didn't love her. He obviously was connected to her and felt for her. But Amnon, his half-brother, actually had this infatuation for her. But is that all verse 1 is actually saying? This is the very first incident that is recorded after David's sin. And is it about Absalom or is it about Amnon? There is absolutely no question, brothers and sisters, that this chapter and the next 6.5 chapters are all about Absalom. Amnon is not a main player. Amnon just gets in the way, and he is the problem that Absalom deals with and gets him out of the way. But the whole turn of events, all cycles around Absalom. I have no question in my mind that I can't actually prove it. I have no question in my mind that Absalom was going to be, in David's mind, the next king. Not Amnon. Absalom. He had personality. He had the good looks of his father. and he was well regarded by people. In fact, he stole the hearts of the people later. Under David's nose, he was a man of incredible influence, and he's only young. He's got a lot of charm. He's got good looks. He's got lots going for him, and he was able to get his own way. He obviously had potential and leadership. He was out there. And now in his late teens, he is named first. And it came to pass that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister. And it so happens that the next bit of the story is about Amnon, but Absalom is the person that's named first. And you know, brothers and sisters, if you get a colour pencil and you colour in Absalom from here, before this chapter, he's mentioned once when he was born. From the start of chapter 13, he's mentioned 100 times in the next few chapters. That is staggering. There's only a handful of people in the entire scripture whose name appears that many times. This man in David's life is exceedingly important. And in the record, if we don't find out what it is, we've missed what the Spirit is trying to teach us. Now, I'd have to say, brothers and sisters, I think I've missed that for years. I don't know whether I've seen everything yet, because the scriptures are like that. They keep on unfolding before us. But Absalom explodes in this record. And you know when he explodes in it? When it, suddenly his name is mentioned, he's just the dominant person. We'll come to verse 21. That's where it starts. He's mentioned a couple of times before that. And it says, and King David heard of these things and he was very wroth. And David did nothing. And Absalom incensed that there was no justice. He was incensed that nothing happened. And you know what? Verse 23, and it came to pass after 2 full years. He waited 2 full years for justice to be delivered in that house. For Amnon to be restrained. And nothing happened. So he took it into his own hands. Because he felt for his sister. He wasn't prepared to sit back. You know, Absalom was only 15 when David sinned, roughly around that sort of age. And as we said before, he must have been significantly impacted by the events that happened around that time. You can imagine a 15-year-old boy knowing what's going on, or at least hearing all this innuendo. What's he going to think? He's going to feel ashamed. He's going to feel hurt. He's going to feel confused and very angry. And he's going to disrespect his father for a while. And that could have been healed if all the circumstances were different. But the circumstances weren't different, brothers and sisters. But what he did know is he loved his sister. And he obviously loved his little family. However many other children there were in that family, we don't know. In that little part of the palace. And Tamar gets asked by David, his father and her father, to go and see Amnon. And she's abused and humiliated and then thrown out. And David does nothing about that. In the mind of a 15-year-old, David was to blame for sending her into that man, into that his brother, who was only 18, who he knew what he was like. And he would have wondered why David didn't know. Well, you can sort of understand from a natural point of view the impact that this is actually having. This entrenched feeling just got worse in his heart. And because nothing happened, things began to brew in his mind. And the plot hatched. And then the deception started. You know, he'd seen all that deception in the palace. He'd seen people whispering. He'd seen people scheming. He'd heard things covered up. And what children see, they do. In verse 24, Absalom came to the king and said, behold now, thy servant hath sheep shearers. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant. Notice this amazing respect, all feigned, all false, all hypocritical. And he comes and invites the king to come as a cover for a plan that he'd already hatched. But I think he knew David wouldn't come. And anyway, if David did come, he could manage that as well. He was a smart young man who had schemed for 2 years to make this happen. In verse 26, it appears David did smell a rat. And he says, then Absalom said, well, if not, I pray thee let my brother Amnon go with us. And the king said, why should he go? But Absalom pressed him. Oh, this is the characteristic of sin, isn't it, brethren and sisters? It presses. It just keeps pressing. And Absalom was a master. He was a master of charm. He was a master of pressure. And in some strange way, he had an influence over David. He had the ability to charm and get his own way. And then the true horror, once he's got his own way, and all his brothers are coming up to 30 kilometres north of Jerusalem to his sheep shearing festival. The true horror of Absalom is revealed. Verse 28. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Mark ye now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, smite him, then kill him. Fear not, for I have not I commanded you, be courageous and valiant." It's almost like the war cry. Come on, men, get together, pull yourself together, we've got a great battle here to fight. And he urges his servants like that. This is just heartless, cold-blooded scheming of an ungodly and bitter man. And he's only, how old? 21? Something like that. And he's going to do this in the presence of all his brothers, amidst festivity, under the guise of bringing them there with hospitality. And just like Amnon before, Absalom is rising as this personification of the flesh. Verse 29. The servants of Absalom did unto Absalom as Absalom commanded. And then all the king's sons got up and ran for their lives. And now the sword enters. The sword enters. Notice, evil shall arise from your own house, David. And then the sword is going to come. And here it is. And evil multiplies. Catch the drama of this, brethren and sisters, because these sons get on their horses and their mules and they gallop as fast as they can to get back to David, but word gets to him before that and he's told that all his sons are dead. Can you imagine? Can we even begin to imagine what that might have meant to David? He tears his clothes and lays on the earth and all his servants don't know what to do. I mean, what would you do, brothers and sisters, in that circumstance with that sort of news? And Absalom, verse 34, flees. You're told that three times, by the way, in the next few verses, 34, 37, 39, 38. Verse 36 says, "And it came to pass, as soon as he'd made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's sons came, lift up their voice and wept, and the king also, and all his servants wept very sore." David's grief, brethren and sisters, was extreme. We can scarcely imagine what that might have been like. And compounded, no doubt, by the words of Nathan. Because what David knew, brethren and sisters, in all of this was that when evil arose out of his house, when he saw that happening, and when the sword entered his own house and his own son had been killed, he knew just this was not just the evil work of teenagers, though it was. This was God at work through providence. This was some of the consequences that God had said, and it sobered him greatly through this whole period. Echo after echo reverberated in his brain, and before his eyes was reliving the horror of his own sin. First of all in Amnon, and then in his sons. You know, look at these. These are just some. You can have a copy of this later if you like, but I won't spend a lot of time on it. But here's David's sin, aspects of David's sin. Look at the amazing parallel with Absalom. The things that are happening in Absalom. Absalom commits adultery, so does David. The sin is covered up, and that's exactly what Absalom does. Tries to deceive Uriah. Well, Absalom deceives David and Amnon. It pressures Uriah to cover. David pressures him. The schemes to kill. They're getting people drunk. They order their servants to do the dirty work. They encourage evil in others. Uriah is killed in the midst of his brethren, and so is Amnon. And then David flees from God, and Absalom flees from David. And then when Absalom comes back, David gives him silent treatment, and that already happened in Amnon's life. So many parallels here, and there's more than that. that it's just quite amazing that David's sin was, well, it had been a turning point in Absalom's young life. It didn't have to destroy him, but it definitely shaped the person he was and played out before him. And Absalom was a reminder to David of all his sin. You know, brothers and sisters, what God was doing with David. You know, when sin actually affects us, when we are involved in sin, and we might repent of our sin, and we might turn back to God, and God will forgive, but the residue of sin is still there. The effects of that sin on our lives, on our minds, does not go immediately. And God sees it necessary to leave the consequences of sin in our life to help us actually understand the terrible sinfulness of sin so that we might actually flee it and not fall into its arms again. Well, here David, he'd wanted to put that sin behind, but so that it would never come back again, God let the consequences go. And there before David played out almost every day of his life. You remember those words he said, "My sin is ever before me." And in a most amazing way, God actually put his sin almost ever before him, almost every day in his own house. And David knew it. David knew that God had done it. He knew that God's hand was there. He wanted it to be different, but he knew it couldn't be. And he knew there were only two options. He either fights against it, he screams and yells and kicks, or he patiently submits to the hand of God. And from here on, the situation even grew worse for the next 10 years. Just as sin uncorrected grows worse and takes control, there's a graphic reminder to us, brothers and sisters. Don't let's just think of David. Let's take these words and what we read in these ensuing chapters. Because what we've got is a graphic reminder to us of the horrific effects of sin if we're not exercised by the consequences of sin. You know, the pleasures of sin, brothers and sisters, are just an illusion. Here is the reality. The reality of sin in the lives of individuals, though we might like to cover it over and we might like to think that it's not, and we might like to deceive ourselves and we might like to deceive other people, just like David did and tried to, in the end, you can't escape it. The effects of sin are shocking. And David was forced, though he'd been forgiven, was forced to have that entrenched and embedded in his mind so that he would never go down that path again. And he would always run into the arms of God every time. And that's what he did. You know, the amazing thing, I think, about this whole period of David's life is that it did exactly what God wanted it to do. It doesn't always in our lives, but it did in his. And that's why he's such an amazing, inspirational example through this period. Well, we come to the end of that chapter, verse 38 and 39, Absalom flees. And the soul of King David longed to go forth to Absalom. Can you understand that? Well, this was a charming young man, absolutely stunningly handsome. It was almost like David reincarnated when he was 17 or 18, because David was like that as well. And he had personality. He had ability. And he was David's son. And his soul went long to go for. He didn't go and get him. He didn't go and see him. That was just the feeling that he had. It was a painful dilemma in David's life. These two impulses, the judicial calling for punishment on Absalom and the paternal, which was calling for restoration of Absalom back. Chapter 14, verse 1, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived the king's heart was toward Absalom. And Joab just got involved. David didn't want him to, but he did. Because David was in a great and painful dilemma. And he would have been better to stay in that great and painful dilemma. His heart was torn by his love of justice and his love, sometimes misplaced, for his son. You know, it's a dilemma that we all feel, brethren and sisters, is it not, in life? We feel this dilemma sometimes in between our relationships with other people and our loyalty to important principles. And David's just another man. He actually feels it. We're seeing this played out. And he's trying his hardest to get this right. And Joab just interferes, just steps in, gets this woman, an actor who comes in and feigns sincerity, tells this story that's going to be calculated to get David, you know, his heart moving. Because David's a man of compassion and a man of justice. And it talks about two sons, and they're fighting against each other. One gets killed, and then the other one's in danger. And David's thinking, oh no, here it all goes again. Here's a repeat of all this, what's been happening in his life. And this woman secures her purpose, and then she turns on David in verse 11 of chapter 14, verse 12 of chapter 14. And the woman said, let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak one word to my lord the king. And he said, say on. And the woman said, wherefore then hast thou thought such a thing against the people of God? For the king doth speak this thing as one which speaketh, which is in fault, in that the king doth not fetch home again his banished. And so she goes on with all this dribble, bits of which were true, and bits of which were rubbish. And she might not as well have said another word, because David didn't hear any more. Because when she said that the king doth not fetch home his banished, she plunged a knife straight through him. It's what he wanted to do. That's what his conscience said shouldn't be done. And David was so touched because he remembered what God had done with him. He remembered that God had not left him banished. And now this woman is telling me. You know, brothers and sisters, the most remarkable thing about here, this man is king of the entire Middle East region. And this peasant woman comes into his palace and starts telling him what he's doing wrong. Any other woman at any other time in any other palace would have lost her head in 5 seconds. David did nothing. He said, you're right. And he immediately knew who was behind it. He knew Joab was behind it. But you know, brothers and sisters, that's only half the story. He knew that if Joab was behind this, and this intricate story had been woven, then God was behind it. Verse 21. I think this is utterly amazing. And the king said unto Joab, behold now, I have done this thing. Go and bring the young man Absalom again. Can you imagine? He's a man that's just deceived him, got this woman to come and play at and try to distort everything. And he says, I'm at fault. Here's the mark of amazing humility, brothers and sisters. Here's the mark of a repented and converted sinner who's prepared to accept God's will despite personal pain. And David submitted. And Absalom came back. Joab runs off and gets Absalom, brings him back. Verse 24, and the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom returned to his own face and saw not the king's face. He still wasn't comfortable. His conscience wouldn't let him completely bring Absalom back into favour. It wasn't a good decision, brethren and sisters. The halfway house proved to be the wrong decision. Because not speaking, as he decided he wouldn't do, and not letting him see his son, is always calculated to produce the wrong outcomes. And it's not for us to judge, brethren and sisters, what David did. In the circumstances, it clearly was wrong. And you know, this is something that's repeated over and over again in all of our lives. Almost everyone at some stage or other has actually given a cold shoulder. And it never produces anything productive or positive. But what does is communication and full and wholesome discussion and open warmth after issues have been talked. Because that's actually what David should have done in hindsight. But this half action robbed him of the opportunity to recover Absalom, and it put in train another great flurry of activity that was going to take the kingdom even further down and going to end up in the death of Absalom. It's just an amazing story, isn't it? Well, I can't. You can barely understand this, brothers and sisters. That having done, and David's now just got his son back into the nation. Verse 25 says, But in all Israel there was none so much to be praised as Absalom for his beauty, from the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head. There was no blemish in him. What an amazing sudden burst in the middle of this record. What on earth is that doing there? Well, it's saying, brothers and sisters, that Absalom, as a young man, now only, he'd been over there for 3 years, so he's only in about 23, 24. He walks back into that nation as a convicted murderer, having shamed the kingship. The whole royal family has been devastated by all these circumstances. And he walks back into the nation, and the nation say, "Oh, how wonderful it is to see you, Absalom," because they didn't think about his criminal record or his morality. They just looked at his good looks. And he wasn't just a perfect physical specimen. Verse 26 tells us he polled his head every year and measured the weight. It was a great spectacle. After the king's weight, publicly he did this. Here's the real Absalom. It could have been different, but all these circumstances rolled on, and he turned, by this stage in his mid-20s, as a proud, self-interested, arrogant, vain egotist. He wasn't cutting his hair like the Nazarites to burn it in devotion to God, representing all that he'd given to God, but as a witness of his own egotism. And the nation loved it. Unbelievable. Or is it? Because that's happened so many times since, and even today. The whole world is mesmerized by the outward appearance. And inside the palace was a man still described as a man after God's own heart, who God had seen past the exterior for when he was only 16. And outside, there was this rising young man who was going to inflict great difficulties on the nation. And we'll take up his story next time.